The reason I have undertaken this set of studies is that I am also the parent of a four-year-old, and her arrival into my life had as a really a more profound effect on the work that I do and the way I think about it than even finishing my PhD. And that because I find myself that the care that she requires, and it is the problem of parenting, is so labor intensive, that I often felt it was pitted against my professional responsibilities. And I began to think about ways in which they really work together, and that indeed the work that parents do, or other persons charged with the care of children, have some significant insights about the theological message of our church that we could share and speak to a wider audience to everyone's benefit. So that's sort of the origins of this set of classes and some of the, what do you read and bring together? And what I have found time and time again as I prepare sermons or whatever, that some of the things I have read in the course of the parenting stuff has been remarkably illuminating. And after a while, I thought, this isn't just accidental, you know, that it keeps coming back. So today, we're taking up the topic of discipline, which I think is undoubtedly the bane of everyone's existence. I have come to the conclusion that part of it is, you know, it's a little bit like the first time I was a professor in a class, and I had a student sort of regard me as the other. And I realized that I was, of course, when you're still in grad, you're still trying to finish your degree when you start teaching. You're a hybrid because you are still at the whim of somebody else's decisions. But I realize now that I had responsibilities and authority, and I just wasn't used to being in that place. When I had a child, those first weeks are rather sweet, you know, I mean, that you don't, and a lot of what goes wrong is accidental, you know, coming downstairs and realizing that your several-month-old infant has eaten the newspaper and dyed her face and her clothes and all that, but you know there was no malice aforethought. She'd have slobbered on anything that was within reach. That what it was the first time that I knew that there was malice aforethought. I mean, that there was thinking about this, that this was, that suddenly this sort of challenging and kind of thing was going to be the primary currency of our exchange. Not an accidental one, but a very significant piece of how she went. And I refer you back with the passage I read from Jane Smiley's article about mothers. Can mothers think? And Jane Smiley, the novelist and fiction writer, wrote in this essay, "And so I gave birth to my child, and I also, I found, gave birth to my subject, the implications of daily power, the way in which one's sense of virtue and the desire to be good and innocent conflicts with the daily exercise of power over the child. I never knew what it felt like to have my actions magnified so enormously by the dependency of another." I mean, she's right, I think, right on the money about what becomes the most conflicted and difficult part of our role as parents, the exercise of power. And I think, you often said, is to avoid it, right? Say, I refuse to be put in that position. It's not an issue that can be sidestepped. Your rejection or neglect or abnegation of the exercise of power is a statement about it. And as has often been pointed, particularly in difficult faculty meetings, I remember somebody said once, look, backing away from it doesn't mean that the power goes away. Somebody is going to take it. There is no vacuum here. It doesn't disappear. And that in some ways one of the hardest things is to come at it and say, we are responsible for how it will be picked up, who will pick it up. And that is the sort of constant definition of parenting that I think is very wearing and very trying. It is, as I have realized, not simply the problem that you can't always just get them to do what needs to be done. it is more often the problem that you're not quite sure how it should be resolved. And you don't have a lot of time to research it when it's happening. You know? Hold that screaming toddler here in the frozen food sections. I'm going to make a phone call and go to the library and I'll be back. It doesn't happen. Many of you, I'm sure, have heard these sort of descriptions of these sort of basic kinds of parenting. Authoritarian, one extreme, permissive as another, and in the middle, one that gets either called authoritative or responsible. I've heard it in this way. And that what you can see is, in some ways, it's the two extremes. The authoritarian, you take the control, you hold it. In some ways, you don't have to give good reasons for what you do. It's just that your job is to do it, and their job is to get on with what they're being told. And I want to say, I mean, it's so easy to make a travesty of this. I think basically, probably looking at the realm of age, a lot of us grew up with a good deal of that. And what has really impressed me in a number of the groups that I've worked with as parents, when I say I worked with them, I mean I've been one of them, a member, a card-carrying, dues-paying member of this group. Now, we had a parent, an expert sort of advice. You know how many of us sort of said, well, actually, it was pretty good sometimes. You know, I mean, it wasn't like it was all like you were being hammered and bullied around. I mean, it was just, it was kind of nice. It was clear, for crying out loud. I like to think of this a little bit about, you kind of move along this spectrum of what is appropriate at different times. And the permissive one, on the other hand, has been sort of the reaction against that how do children ever know themselves and find themselves unless they're given lots of freedom? And it sounds good, but those of you who have ever had the product of a permissive parenting situation in your home realize that very quickly you want to meet outside on neutral ground when they play together. You know, I mean, you sort of say, this is not, there's something missing here. And that actually, in some ways, the child is being depressed. The parents mean well, but this is not working. So the one that sort of comes in the middle is what we sort of been urged to look at, of what it is to be authoritative and responsible, which it is, what we're tying all the way along here in discipline is the sharing of power, how it will be shared and parsed out in a family. And that it's not a foregone conclusion, as in the authoritative, who is the final word and the final arbiter. Right? But the other side is not to sort of leave everybody to do their own thing. Because what you end up with there is really not a family, but a lot of sort of ricocheting, you know, people who may learn what they want and what they need, but alas, don't learn anything about how to fit that into a world which they have to inhabit with other people. Right. Okay, which is a very important step. And that, I think, if we think about our discipline, is how we're helping our children make that step. Okay. When I was back visiting my parents at the beginning of the summer, I told you about this friend of mine who has a little girl she adopted who's just about 7 days older than Lucy, and they always drive down from Wheaton to our house. And the girls had filled their wading pool and they were charging around and I mean they were just having a great time. And one of the things that we have realized is that oftentimes children are so socially responsible in this sense. They're with a group where everybody doesn't have like the same skills, development of kids. I mean, it's like, well, one thing we can all do is chaos together. And so it's the inclusive activity, and somewhere along the line it sort of gets to that, you know, and even the bed, they just want to run around and shriek and throw stuff. We're sitting out in the yard, you know, and they're all around us, and Laura starts talking to me about it. She said, I just think your parents are wonderful. And I said, well, I do too, but I'd be sort of interested. It's always helpful to know why somebody else does it. She said, well, there's no way my parents could spend a day like this. And I said, well, you've noticed my mother went to do volunteer work and my father is down in his bedroom. So, I mean, but she said, oh, but even that, I mean, they know how to enter, and they know how to get out of the way when they can't take it anymore, but they don't have to control it. They don't have to make, because she said, you know, She said, her parents are in their 80s, mine are in their late 70s, but she said, my daughter would do one of these things, and all I would hear afterwards is, "What? Don't you have any idea how to bring up a child? That's just so holy and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da." She said, I just don't know. She said, so I'm just astonished that they can, and that was very helpful for me to stop and think, well, they are darn good parents. They're darn good at this other end of the range, too, about our negotiating what everybody needs to be in this place together. But as Laurie said these kind things, you know, and I also thought about the time that there is a way that one of the most difficult things about our being parents is that it's a very public activity. And that adds this pressure to it, because although Laura was saying it, I was thinking of just a couple of nights before where Lucy had one of these tantrums, you know, I don't want every children, but when they have it, they're just totally out of control, screaming. Now, we'd had one of these in California where I remember shipping water out of the bathtub at me, you know, and I just said, bath time is over. Well, it just went from there, and she's screaming, and I'm thinking, somebody's going to call child protection. If I heard, and it was great. One of the people at her daycare told him about it. She said, here's the key. If they never hear you screaming back or really getting out of control, they know what, people know what's going on, you know, I'll buy you any Barbie you want. Don't do that at my grandpa's. She did. And she did it late at night. And I'm holding her, you know, just so, because she's out of control. But, you know, and here's my poor father standing in the doorway in his pajamas, looking like some kind of mythic figure of woe. You know, like what? And then when she finally broke, you know, and I saw him come over and look over at her in bed, but I realized we were all, my mother said, I'm so afraid she'll make herself sick. I said, I'm afraid she's going to make me crazy, you know, that we could. But what I realized in this was at one point when she just out of it, what she said to me is, I don't know what's wrong, Mommy, I'm scared. And I thought, it's really upsetting for me is that's what we have in common. I don't know what's wrong either, and I'm scared. But my job now is to give the possibility for her not to be overwhelmed by that, even though I am. I don't know. And at some point, I have to make a decision. Is there something here that requires professional intervention? Am I doing something? I mean, you just go tearing yourself apart, and this is such hard work, because what somebody says, what is the right thing to do? See, that's it. Some people say, oh no, the last thing you want to do is make a child feel forced. You never want to invade their body. You never, you know, and other people say the thing you have to do with that is give them a very real physical sense of containment, because that's what they think they don't. So I am saying techniques abound. But there's no uniform code of child raising. And in a way, you really are finding a path through this. And what works one time may not work another. But that's what this is about for you and for me. And I think we have to take very seriously. Who wouldn't want to retreat between authoritarian? I mean, there were times, you see, where it would have given both of us more comfort. If you're going to act like that, you need to stay in your room until you're over it. And I don't want anything broken in there. Right? And what my friend said, and this was interesting, I said, well, you know, gosh, I don't remember doing this stuff when I was little. I said, but of course, when I was little, it was a long time ago. And my mother said, I don't know whether you did or not, because of course I would have repressed it. There are other things I'd rather remember about you. Which is, I think, a kind of a nice, helpful sort of, you know, you get by it. And but my friend said, I know I didn't. She said, because by the time I was this age, I was thoroughly afraid. Now, don't get me wrong, I mean, her parents were not, but it was just, there were a lot, and you didn't cross it, and you just knew it. You just knew it in your gut, you know. And she said, I've made a conscious decision. I don't want it to be that way. She said, but you don't make a choice like that without some consequences. And what I want to say is, all of us, do you find one of the things you really begin to do is suspend some judgment? How many of you, before you had children, would be in the grocery store and see somebody just saying, and you go, oh, that's so humiliating. I would never do that. I would never do that. Nobody should talk to a child like that in public. Now I find myself thinking, thank God you're doing it here in public, because that'll set a limit. If you were feeling like it was escalating beyond what you could bear, you are not going to smack that child repeatedly in a grocery store. Do you know what I mean? Where if you were in a private, it might be, and I don't mean that as a bad, horrible parent. I'm talking about somebody who is just at the end, who also has, and I think if it happens here, it gets aired, and on both sides, both for the parent, no farther, and for the child, it sets containment. It sets a kind of boundary. And I think of that very differently now than I used to. Very differently. And I find myself oftentimes when that happens wanting to say not something. I think it's very shaming sometimes for a child when a stranger says, you listen to your mother. Stop that. She doesn't need 16 cartons of fabric softener, you know, or whatever. But what it is just to say something to the parent, you know, about that just says, this is not, what should I say, not terrible space to be in. Do you know what I mean? To talk about territory that's familiar. No, we've been there. You're not in a place that no self-respecting, decent parent would ever get. You're in a place where we all go. And that's why I think, especially on this issue of discipline, to say if we can't always successfully impose discipline. See, we've gotten a cat, and I've looked at the tremendous difference between what it is to squirt the cat with a squirt gun when he does something I don't like, and the complexity of that with Lucy. You know, and if there isn't just this immediate cause and reaction, we can't always make it happen. But the bigger problem, I think, is we don't always know what should happen. And just recognizing that, we make decisions in sometimes the most hellish of circumstances. You know how they say after a big loss, never make any critical decisions for at least a year. Right. Well, suddenly you're in the middle of this. You are, you must think of me, you know, when the studies have shown that once adrenaline gets kicking when you're angry, it's still going for hours. And they'll say, this is the worst time, sort of, well, maybe with a partner, you can have the wisdom to disengage. And to some extent, you can with a child, but you still have to do something, and you have to decide like that, and you usually have to do it under scrutiny. So I lay all that to say, recognize it and be kind to yourself. One of the real struggles in this is as much as you can, in some ways, to disengage, to be able to observe, because of course that's what they're trying to do, is draw you in. And at some point, you know, when you and that's attending to yourself. It's not just that they feel what they feel and give it a name. Know what you feel. Because it's very dangerous territory. But in some ways, I mean, you're not dealing with an equal. Do you know what I mean? And precisely because they're not your equal, you're at a disadvantage. A friend of mine told me once, she thought one of the great secrets to a good marriage was learning how to fight fair. And I suspect many of you would agree. I mean, but you can't, you can't start there with a child. You can set some ground, but they're going to learn what fighting fair is over time from you. But in the interim, it's not going to be easy. So this is a place, it seems to me, particularly with discipline, although you hate the scrutiny, I think this is the part of parenting that really has to be a communal activity. I think one of the worst things that happens when parents are isolated to try to sort this all out by themselves. They are, in some ways, you're interested parties. And that this is, it's just draining. And this is one of the places, I think, whether formally or informally, as groups of parents, they can come together and talk about specific situations and get ideas from how you dealt with something like that. That this is just imperative. That a lot of it escalates into the kind of violent and abusive behavior that often happens because people simply are at the end of their ropes. And they don't have other resources to draw off of. And how we might build, as a believing community, some of those possibilities, not only for our own members, but I think a tremendous way of outreach into communities where people in certain socioeconomic, their options and their resources diminish more and more often, that this is a place, it's right to ask for help. It's right to talk about, because do you also find, sometimes I think there's real shame. I was sitting there the other night thinking, well, it'll come a point where you just can't say these things, that Lucy did this or Lucy did that, because it's a betrayal. But at the same time, isn't that exactly how many relationships go right down the tubes? Because we think there's somehow or other something betraying or shaming to talk about this. Where if we can just say, well, it's just a thing that happened, let's think about how we might engage it. And I just encourage you to push past, and not just with a partner, if you have a partner in your parenting. Because you may well see it differently, and that can add to the problem. That may not be the best sounding board. Because there, if we're talking about the sharing and exercise of power, there's the other place that's happening, not only between parent and child, but between parents. Okay. So, what I'd like to say is, now as I look at that, with you, I've gotten lots of, well, why don't you try this, or why don't you try that? But what about the big picture as we think about this work? Because disciplining is, well, first of all, we need to think of it as a key form of how we do the work of parental love. And yesterday when I talked about nurture, I thought, I don't want it ever to sound like I'm saying nurture against discipline. I think that's one of the problems, is that we need to be able to think about, we need this work of discipline as being one of the foremost ways in which children are nurtured. And that to some extent, we have to get over our own fear of it and discomfort with it to be able to explore its possibilities. The big picture then, as I say, techniques abound. I'm sure you've all heard about, if they do this, they're logical and natural consequences. They need to learn the consequences of their behavior, but be sure that it's a consequence and not a punishment. I remember a classic example when I was visiting my nephew, who's a charming young man, but he was quite clumsy and always very careless at the table. So you ended up feeling like you were having dinner in the middle of the Great Lakes for years. And I was there one time visiting, and I wanted to watch something on television. And he said, well, I'm on a television restriction. And I said, I can talk to your parents about that and see if we can see this thing anyway, but could you tell me why? And he said, I knocked 3 glasses of milk over into my crotch one night at dinner. And I found myself thinking, am I hearing this right? I said, and now you're not supposed to watch television? I don't get the connection. But it was when he just looked at me and he said, oh, you know how it is, Annie Jane, I just caught her at a bad moment. Now, I thought there was sort of a remarkable wisdom here that even he could recognize that this was not a logical or natural consequence of what he had done. I just want to say, who cares? Sometimes you don't want to be logical. You don't want to be natural. But by and large, if what you want them is to learn, see, again, look at what happens in that way. I do this over here, and the deus ex machina comes in from above and imposes this on me, rather than them learning something about how their behavior affects people and sorting it out. So I think that the other thing is, much like being a pastor, maybe this is one of the reasons I've put these together, it seems to me that one of the things the Reformation reacted against was a definition of the priestly role becoming more and more sort of judge. I mean, what they saw is that you discerned amongst confessed sins what was serious, what was not, and so that the whole structure of the church sort of became more and more juridical. And that there is a way in which that's not what you want to be doing. You want to sort of, I mean, that the church itself is to bring people to a recognition of their empowerment with the gifts of the Spirit and let them work some of these things out. Well, think about it as a parent. What is the place, especially if you have more than one child, that constantly the role they would like to assign you is either judge or referee? I remember a friend of mine who said, I just feel like I ought to go around the house with a whistle going, into the penalty box, you know? Your brother gets 2-3 throw shots. And that, of course, there's a way in which that's its own manipulation. You see, it's its own sort of shifting of control. That what it is, I mean, two lines I loved is when you look at it, say, a friend was visiting us with her little boy and Lucy, and this just beatific way she would turn around and say, I'm confident you two can work it out. Or, I'm confident you two can work it out, and I'm not really interested. Which was, and then when it got huge, you know, when there are multiple children, and I mean, and it is, you have to think of self, if you have, you know, three kids or more, you're basically running a daycare center. And you might as well think of some, I mean, it's true, I don't mean this is a joke, and think about some of the ways, watch it. Did you see them all march over to see the juggler? Could you imagine if each of us had our own child? Trying to get them to sit, watch, drink, and not. Technical thing, you know, doing this, but that you're not a referee. And one of the ones I remember was always getting to the bottom of how this started. It takes a lot of time, so that you could be fair. And I remember being quite liberated when they said, they come in, you say, you know what, I don't care who started it. But I want to be clear, you are all responsible for ending it. Right? Or somebody keeps eating in the room where they're not supposed to. Well, it's always Johnny. We know what the rules are about this family space. These will be. We know what the consequences are. And so you need to work this out and be sure it doesn't happen. And it's not my job to work it out that it doesn't happen. It's a very... kind of artful. Well, that's not fair. That's not the issue. That's really not the issue here. And think of the number of times you have to say, I mean, see my daughter, and if you're all kicked, their favorite one is, I think my mommy doesn't love me anymore. I mean, it's a very quick, sort of the classic move. I think of it with the Reformation. Wait a minute, we were talking about indulgences, and suddenly you're saying that what the issue is that I don't honor the Pope. You know, the quick move they made for Luther. Well, Lucy's quick. Oh, I don't think my mommy loves me anymore. And I've learned how to say, well, that's not the issue right now. That's just not the issue right now. The issue right now is the cat's water dish has been kicked over. And you need to do something about that. And so I think those techniques are immensely helpful. But in the day-to-day matters, here's the thing, is that you can sort of survive an engagement. That's what I go. Don't you have days like that? You come and I go, whew, I get a little battle medal. I did well. You know, I got through that. It didn't deteriorate completely. I didn't lose my temper or say something I'm really sorry for. We got out of the restaurant before somebody asked me to leave. The first time that happened in Minnesota, I really thought that Lucy must be a child from hell because Minnesotans are supposed to be so nice. That if anybody in a restaurant in Minnesota that was geared to children would say, why don't you take her outside, and it was 15 degrees below zero, that she must have really been horrible, you know? And sort of to sort of insulate yourself against those things. But we have to, I mean, that's not enough. Is thinking, what's the big picture to look like? What is this work all about? Why is it our work? And does it have anything to teach us about who we are as children of God and how God is present among us. And I think, actually, it has an immense amount. Of course, the big picture, the high road, is not always going to sustain you in some particularly nasty moment. But for you to think about what is a trajectory, where am I trying to get from here to there? Not just that we get home speaking to one another, but where do I want this child to be in 5 years, in 15 years? You know, what do I want to come out of this that I can build on? And that has been very helpful to me, to try to think in those terms, because the temptation, of course, to sort of shoot from the hip in individual events, and then what's striking is, have you ever talked to your parents about something you really remember when you were little, and they don't remember it at all? Mm-hmm. But what a child does is begin, however, string those things together into some web of meaning about who they are, and if they're bad, or if they're whatever. And so what I think you want to be to think of, what is going to be consistent? What's going to allow you, I mean, in some sense, to say something or do something, lay something down here that can be deepened, that can be expanded, so that when they begin to put pieces together, not all, and the other positive thing is sometimes you're going to do it wrong, and that's okay. But they're going to recognize it. See, that's going to be the powerful thing, is that, woo, that time we really lost it. Right? Not sort of... Not a child who in some ways is always taking the temperature of his or her self-worth or standing in the family or the world by, are you pleased, are you angry, are you this, are you, see what I mean? Much the way I think what we're saying is, isn't that the very freedom we're claiming that the gospel gives us in living in relationship to God, that what we're not always doing is one head over our shoulder thinking, am I going to get slammed? You know, is this the piece that can't be, it's not a mature relationship and it's not a stable one. Right? So that's been sort of the way I have to say that in dealing with my child and with a lot more children now because I'm just around them, I think I have matured in my relationship to my Heavenly Father dramatically in thinking about that. I was surprised in a way how kind of whiny and clingy I was in some sense, in bad senses, and not being able to recognize that what I needed was being offered to me quite freely. So let me say a little something. There, remember this piece of James Smiley's on the dilemma of power over the child. Our discomfort with the exercise of it, and I want to be very clear about my sense of our vulnerability. I have a friend I've worked with who's a therapist who made to me a very, very illuminating comment about the life of parents of children generally in toddler years and adolescence, which, I mean, and you might as well know, you can sort of like prepare yourself. There are periods of huge instability. I mean, where it just escalates, you know? And especially with toddlers, sometimes you talk to people, they hit that age, and the next minute, it was like, I mean, it's part of it. It'd be one of the very helpful things, if you read about development, is just to know sometimes, they're just feeling weird in their bodies. Our bodies are pretty much what they're going to be. Perhaps a little more pear-shaped over time, but you know, I mean, in some ways right now, it can be something, although I think as we age, we see some of this, but how dramatic it is for them in growth, the chemical imbalances. I remember being stunned reading at a certain age, children's eyesight, what they usually are good at for a while is kind of middle. Then there's a point where the acuity of their eyesight begins to develop to see things close up and far away. So suddenly you'll have a child who is doing really well who'll start falling down because the piece that they've suddenly lost was the piece they used to be sure of in the middle. Okay? And they said, this is terribly disconcerting and frightening for them. And we'll get acted out. Now, it helped me a lot because Lucy, I could tell when it happened. But if I hadn't known that, think too, as we know, just in adolescence. That the physical changes are accompanied also by some significant social changes. Both in toddlerhood and adolescence, there's a kind of a new autonomy and an expectation of being able to do things. So there's an attraction and a repulsion. They're excited about it and they're scared. So when you're in the midst of that kind of really volatile situation, this therapist friend of mine said, you know, what I have realized in talking with a lot of parents is that because when their children get like that, they have no idea what's going to set them off or how they're going to blow up, that they live in situations very akin to what it is to be in an abusive partnership, where what you're doing is walking around on eggshells, trying not to do anything that will set it off, and that basically they're really quite terrified of their children. And that it makes sense, but the fact is that then the whole system is dysfunctional. It's misfiring, right? Because precisely because the children are in some ways frightened of themselves, they don't need to have mirrored back to them that they really are unbearably scary. See? And but what I want to make clear to you is this is a natural reaction. You have right to feel, if you feel like you're living in a situation with all the potential of being abused, we're sort of struck by this professional saying, well, that's right. You know, that they're really, that some of the dynamics are similar. So, on one hand, then, we are in a very vulnerable situation. It's frightening, it's costly. At the same time, as I think about how vulnerable they are, and that perhaps, just as that mindfulness that we are called, think of the times in our discipleship we are called to try to see what is happening or how something is experienced through the eyes of the neighbor. That in a sense, our call as the servants of our neighbor is God's great gift of freedom from self-absorption. To be able to see beyond that. And I remember two things that I read that were really helpful. One was, he said, before you say or do anything, imagine what it would be like to be in that body on the receiving end of what you're about to say. And in some sense, recovering what it was as a child. I know the difference between the, oh, I think my mommy loves me, the sort of, she actually has a little kind of like a chant. It's like a little Gregorian chant of her sorrows. One time she was in a swing, we're swinging her, and she's saying, I have accidents in my pants, and it makes my mommy mad, singing away. But I try, you know. And it really was. And then the other one, when you can feel it physically in them when they are really terrified that this is a line crossed beyond which they aren't going to get back to you. Be mindful of that and catch it. Remember the things that were said or done to you that made you feel that way when you were little. Another one, I thought the parent educator I've worked with in Berkeley, a delightful woman named Leah Statman, has three children, and she was telling us about one time her daughter in adolescence at 13, where they just can embarrass you beyond, I mean, they'll just do things. And her daughter had done something, and it goes the other way around, yes. Yeah. Did something that was just, and she said, I was standing there saying, don't you realize how rude that is? What were you thinking of? And as a sign, she said, of where she thought her parenting had succeeded, was not in saying that, but that the girl stopped and looked at her and said, Mom, you've had 42 years to figure it out, and I'm only 13. That, she said, that was a helpful one, too, to stop and think, that's right. It's a slow process. And in a way, just when she was feeling like it was sort of like her child giving her that adult identity. You're 42 and you get it right. That's right, so I'm up to this job. I'm 42 and I do get a lot of it right. I can do this job. You know, from her child, that I think are good ones in a way, just kind of to set a wall on them when we need it. And there's the piece that I'd like to move to now and say that where I have found most helpful thinking about this. One of my teaching colleagues at
Luther, when we did the Confessions course together, we did a section on the Lord's Prayer. And he said, you know, I like many things about the new wording because I think it is more accessible to younger people. But he said, you know, one passage I would like to take back to the old wording is, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against one another. And he said, because I think that really captures sort of the big picture about how much of what doing wrong or doing ill is about trespassing into places where you ought not go or in ways you ought not go, and the whole language of boundaries. And as we talked about that afterwards, I thought, what an interesting way to think about what it is as you discipline, as you work with a child, that in a way it is precisely this recognition and setting of boundaries, that you set some for them. So precisely the fact that when your daughter is 42, she will know that that was rude, right? Hopefully earlier, right? But also that they become competent and confident in the setting of their own, right? What qualifies as a trespass? And here's the piece that for me, I've been thinking, what are the sort of values I would like to look at in setting boundaries? And three I've come up with is safety, honesty, and compassion. Right? Honesty in that you may not always be able to have it the way you want, but I would like my daughter, as I like myself, to know why I have done this the way I have done it, even if it's not perfect. Do you know that kind of honesty, that kind of self-knowledge? Compassion in that somebody who was here with us yesterday was talking to me about running up against this thing where the daughter doesn't want to go to church and she can't be in these activities, and it becomes a reason to resent her father who's a pastor, and on and on and on and on it goes, you know, and why can't I have what I want? To say, the part is, you can know, I want Lucy to know that's what she'd rather have. But here's that piece about saying, but you don't live just by yourself. This thing about boundaries with compassion is how they begin to recognize and live within, beginning with a family unit, but expanding well beyond that, to say, I'm happy to hear clearly what it is you think you should have. And now we have to move to this language of what should we have? What is going to work within this group, where we set our boundaries not sort of in splendid isolation, but in relationship to each other? And I think for many of us, of course, one of the key ones is safety. That, as somebody put it to me, you know, you don't want the first time your child makes a decision about what's wise to do to be on prom night when people are going home drunk. If you haven't let that take responsibility for a long time, they're not going to have the courage to say no. And so holding that ahead, what is it to say, these are where I put, because this is where I feel secure, respected as an individual. That beginning early on, insofar as one can give them some of that freedom to begin practicing it, right? And seeing it modeled. That I find sometimes when I make decisions now about things, I actually will do a rationale a little bit, not only to myself, but to Lucy. I don't think we're going to do that because, to tell you the truth, I don't feel safe. Right? And why I wouldn't. So I think that those pieces about, if we look at this in terms of trespassing, and isn't that what it's about in a family? I mean, every time something blows up and you want to yell it, they've trespassed. I mean, that is what a big piece of this is. And tied with it is forgiveness. Learning what it is to forgive. Which doesn't mean you just put up with it. I think oftentimes what they begin to realize forgiveness can mean is I speak out, and then we talk about how we can resolve this so that various interests are engaged and honored. Indeed, I brought one. This is my our little parenting manual. What I loved about this woman's class is this was so short for reading and sort of easy to refer to. But one of the things that she pointed out, in just in this process of trying to get children to do, is learning to work at it together. How many times have you, let's sit down. This is the problem. What are possible solutions? And they're recorded, you know, sort of without judgment. And then everybody talks about what's going to work for us. And then what I love is the idea that you try it out. And then you come back and say, is it working or not? That it seems to me sort of lowers the drama about who absolutely has to be right, but puts everybody, see, this is what I mean about good power sharing. You see, I mean, everybody has to listen, everybody gets to offer something, and everybody gets sort of to do a little evaluation. That it's time consuming, but it begins to build those things you're hoping they're going to be able to do for themselves when, frankly, you aren't there in their dorm at college, right? Or you aren't there when they go out with somebody who thinks it would be fun to get high. Or heist a car, just for the heck of it. I mean, if they don't practice on the little ones, why should we think that they're just going to get it when the big ones come? Okay? I think another one that I found very helpful is, all right, you come to a solution, and they aren't doing it. And you could say, well, no, I thought that's what we agreed we were going to do. I thought we had an agreement. This is a favorite of mine. Gosh, you know. Now, I thought we said, and instead of like, you chiseler, you didn't keep your word, you know, sort of. Is what I'm trying to say, do you feel ready to do that now? Or aren't you up to it yet? That one of the things, you see the kind of face and not turning it into a power thing. It's not between what I want and what you want, or shaming the child, but just saying, okay, well, we know that, and you're not ready to do that yet. And we'll come back another time when you are. This is oftentimes one, are you ready to stop calling everybody else on the playground a butthead, or do you not feel up to that measure of self-restraint? You know? And perhaps if you don't, it's time for us to go home. We'll come back another day. You know, that I found, and sometimes, another thing to remember, we push ourselves so much as parents. How many of you can go, like, I mean, I can go for hours in a day and not eat. I'm exhausted and I know it. I even find days where I stop and think, when are you going to, like, say going to the bathroom counts? You know, that you might like just want to do that before you encounter the next person that you're supposed to respond to with sensitivity and attention. You know, or I'm sure, see, one of mine is with Lucy. Do you think we could do two more errands? One of the biggest things for me is to let go and say, Lucy, I have two more errands we could do. Are you up to making two more stops, or do you want to go home? Oh, I can't tell you how that was. It was terrible. I mean, it was big. And she said, I want to go home. And I was all ready to come back and say, but you know, the cat's just about out of his favorite. And I thought, back off. You gave her a choice. She spoke it. And if you try to talk her out of it, what are you telling her? What are you telling her? And so let me say, this is the other side of it. There's sometimes the discipline will be discipline you have to apply to yourself. Because they just won't let you go on with things the way you're used to doing them. You know? And I've been astonished. I had no idea I was so controlling. Talk about not in touch, huh? But, I mean, I really didn't. Yes?
There's a book in the bookstore called How to Talk So
Children Will Listen and Listen So Children Will Talk.
Children Will Talk. It has some marvelous tips about this communication.
Yes. And wonderful scenarios.
Yeah.
It's fun to read.
I was helped a lot with these choices in the 1992 presidential campaign, because the parenting books I had read define the middle ground as democratic. Democratic parenting, you know, the negotiation of choices. And I realized that year that I didn't get to vote for an ideal candidate for president. I could vote for Bush or Clinton. And if it didn't like those, there was parole. And it was like, I don't like these choices.
Yeah.
But when you talk about being gentle with yourself and thinking about this in relationship with an eternal parent, to recognize and be honest about the own limitation of our choices.
Yes, exactly.
So real. I mean, yes. The other word for boundary is limitation.
Right.
We are limited.
Right.
And I would love to buy you whatever you want.
Right.
But we have to live within these choices.
Yes.
And allow them. And so, it was a kind of strange way.
And that, yes, and there to say, and having recognized that you have an input in how we'll set the priorities there, but that's just, well, and I think you get to where I'd like to include, what does this say? And I think some very significant things about how we think about our relationship to God, especially for those of you who are Lutheran, coming out of a tradition that's ferocious about the distinction between the law and the gospel, and that the second use of the law classically is the one that crushes you with the sense of your unworthiness and your inability to please God, and therefore makes you ripe, fertile ground for hearing the good news of the gospel. As I said to some of you last, if you were here last week, that one of my colleagues once said, as a three-point sermon, this one is... You think you're hot stuff, but you're really shit, and the good news is God loves shit. And this is somehow or other not good news. Nobody wants to be, nobody really wants to be a charity case for the love of anyone. And I think what we begin to realize here in our own care of these is that, yes, there is really anger involved. Kind of an outrage, a disappointment, a terror at the face of the things that our children can do that go wrong, as in ourselves. That is mirrored in what we understand as the thundering wrath of God against injustice and cruelty. Let us be sure that when we are angry, we're for things that matter and not because they just didn't make us look good, but because they come up against values that matter to us. But that as in our understanding of God, anger is a penultimate word and state. It is not the defining one, and it stands under that very umbrella of the primary word of love. You don't generally bother to get really angry at people in some ways that you don't care about. That the level of God's engagement, to have a heart broken and to be infuriated, is precisely not because, oh gosh, I'm going to have to make do with shit and love it, but because God sees so much more. And in that sense, as a parent, that's the other thing. Indeed, I've often thought that God, we talk about what it is to come against a sinner. The Lutheran teaching has always been that it's not because there's some people who cooperate and some people who are just hopeless, as we've often heard first and second children described in a family, right? Hey? But that our teaching has been that the resistance of sin is such that everyone God comes up against is hostile, frightened by the approach, resistant to the intervention, and desperate to be freed from this. I think when my nephew was about 12, he came to visit me, and he's a wonderfully, but as is typical at that age, there would just go on and on and on about every little thing until you find yourself just saying something and just wham, just cutting, and he would weep. And I stopped and I thought, this is the precarious balance in which God comes to us. Feisty, hungry, uncertain, and unbelievably vulnerable. And that how it is the gospel enters into our lives is a word that can call to account and give life. Calls, names what is wrong because there is so much that is good. That as we think of ourselves being, I hope I will find, I didn't bring this book with me because I didn't put this together until the other night, so I hope I will find it in the bookstore to give you this passage tomorrow. Roberta Bondi, a theologian who teaches at Emory University, has written two lovely volumes. The first one is called Memories of God, Theological Reflections on a Life. And in that, she talks at length about what it was to understand herself as a child of God, especially God as Father. And she realized that one of the problems for her was that child of God sort of became arrested development. that somehow or other what that meant was that she was always standing in under judgment, always sort of needy and dependent and passive. And what she came to realize is that our call to discipleship is that what God's parenthood to us is drawing us on so that we can become the adult friends of God. That's what God's children will be and are. Sort of as I think of it sometimes, we're in the family business now, you know. We're on that other lawn, and that if we can think indeed that is what we are calling our children to, that even as we understand this use of the law that speaks the truth, a painful and condemning truth, it is done so that real possibility might be recognized and used. Right? That we are simultaneously saint and sinner. And I think we always hear that as if that sainthood were sort of a as if, instead of a proclamation of a condition of real ability. That, and the same works for our children. That God coming to us as those trapped in, think of me, all that sense of helplessness and turmoil and what should I be and where should I go, and it doesn't help me to be told I'm a sinner and doubt it, to just say, let's take a good look at it, mirroring the good that is there, better, frankly, than we can ever see it. And I think that's one of the important things we need to do for our children. And I know it's hard, in the worst of moments, to mirror, because we see in them what is a distinct beauty. Remember right, that passage about Adam and Eve, that what they saw in one another was a unique creation of God before which they could only fall silent in a certain awe and humility. That we hold that for our children, as our Heavenly Father holds it for us. And then built in a kind of realism, the realism of being simultaneously saint and sinner, so you don't aim for the wrong things and break your heart. That you are aware of the real dangers and attentive to them, and in the midst of it, never lose hope in the possibilities. I mean, isn't that the world we want to design for our children? A world full of dangers and full of possibilities. And God's sense of, you're baptized, God looking over and saying, I'm sure you can do it. I'm not really interested in who started it, but I trust you all to be able to work it out and get on to the things that matter. Right? That we want God as our judge and our referee. Oh, those nasty people. Can't we see what the Bible says about them? I'm just saying, God's saying, been there, done that. That is not my final place to be. Calvin, in a lovely image, talks about what the work of salvation, of justification, is, that we know God now as Father rather than judge. That, my eyes were opened to that in such a new way in the parenting thing. Be a mom or a dad, not a judge. And one other piece in all the work of self-esteem, see, I think the baptismal message of simultaneously saint and sinner is good self-esteem material, in certainly in contradistinction to many in our society who think the word of sin is quite harmful. I think it depends on how it's delivered. But I was struck one day when we were watching Barney, and Grandpa was there, and somebody was on, and all these little children, and he said, you can be anything you want to be. And I remember so struck, my father looked up quite seriously, and he said, but that's not true. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I would have never told you that you could grow up to be an Olympic gymnast. I would have never, I said, you can't be anything you want to be. He said, I don't really think that's helpful. And I was so struck at the wisdom of that. Of saying, you know, what's the balance here about giving our, that's part of our mirroring to our children, of realism. That I think is precisely the gift that God gives us that creates a true realm of freedom. So in conclusion, let me just say, I think that's what God looks at. This is hard work,
that God has confidence in us, in our ability to do this. And that's why we're parents. See? We don't have to do it perfectly. Who even knows what it would look like perfectly? It is a question of doing it faithfully. And in that, you are empowered. And we can empower one another. And that is part of our calling when the task is too heavy to carry it for others. So, thank you. Tomorrow we'll talk about letting go. The good news is it doesn't remain a slave intensive forever. That's what my mom said. She's almost 80, but she's making the most of it. Finally free at last!
Thank you.
Thanks. See you tomorrow.